Right, I believe we are now live. Or we, yep, should be now. Hello, we're here to have a look at the second half of the essay I was looking at, not Monday, but the Monday past, because the Monday previous I had a rotten cold and was of no use for reading large amounts of text. But today I'm joined by Peter Quinas, who's, I think you're sort of much like me and interested in maybe specifically discussing more these parts of kind of libertarian theory where it's attacking things that people don't normally consider.
The normally what when people are talking about libertarian theory, they're talking about things that are well, theoretical, but technically not practical in a it's what w would happen after. It's what would happen once all of this bureaucracy is torn apart and we can start anew. I think what we're talking about here, and what I've been trying to talk about as much as possible lately, is that meme of from South Park, the underpants gnomes, collect underpants, question mark, profit. What's in the middle? What's going to get us there? And I think that when you're Tapa, and I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of libertarians like to live in theory land, because theory land, you don't have to do anything except be right. You don't have to talk to somebody about running for local office or maybe raise money to get someone elected mayor, someone who's very empathetic to our cause or on our side explicitly. You don't have to do that. And then they have all the excuses in the world. Well, that's statism. I've famously said that I went into a group on Facebook and there was a poll that said, who was a bigger statist, Murray Rothbard or Hans Hermann Hoppe? And I look at that now and I'm just like, and maybe 4 or 5 years ago I would have answered honestly. I look at that now and just like, well, I mean, you guys are living in fantasy land because Murray didn't think the state was just going to vanish one day, and all of a sudden, everything he wrote in For a New Liberty was going to come into existence. Something had to. That's why 90s Rothbard, which is another thing that I viewed for so long, is so important because if you dig down into a lot of the Rothbard Rockwell report, all those things, you will find a lot of good tactical things in there, but I think not so much as Hoppe. I think Hoppe just went beyond, and
Well, it's the sort
so.
of era within which Rothbard has a kind of paleo-conservative tactical alliance, and therefore kind of looks at things through their lens, and I think to a certain extent almost kind of steps outside his role as a pure sort of analyst via economic logic as to someone that genuinely has like values that they care about. Because you get some moments of that in some of his longer works, but in sort of shorter essays, it's almost he's sort of writing in a similar capacity almost to Sam Francis at times, which is quite interesting. But to I don't know, bring it back round to the essay. I don't know, I think it's sort of some of the points I was trying to make is summarizing the first half would be that Hoppe's talking very strictly about economic methodology and economic historians, and that through their methodology, be it Marxist or neoclassical or whatever mental tool set they use to indicate the important parts of history that they should look at, always then determines some kind of narrative out of that. And because of the average person, I think he quotes directly from Hayek, there's something along the lines of, the public is not used to or capable of abstract reasoning on a general sense, which is very true. And it's the sort of it's the anti-egalitarian reckon or sort of recognition that separates any form of realistic liberal theory from very unrealistic liberal theory, one that has a sort of assumed nature that man is free. And that those two misconceptions come about for very similar reasons. But the very sort of IDW type kind of foundations that are evident through Pinker in this is that he is not He's not tied to anything. He's not rooted to anything other than maybe utilitarianism. So when he tries to make a positive case for something, it's you know, it has no teeth. Even in a sense of looking at liberalism as like a class analysis and arguing against the state as, you know, an authority in the way that libertarianism does, he doesn't even step into the bounds of that. So it all just falls down under the criticism of anything that's tied to a more strong sense of positivism. Sorry, I just kind of rambled there.
You're fine. Well, I think that one of the good things here is that APA, unlike a lot of other libertarians, most libertarians, understands the power of narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the progressives have a narrative. Now, their narrative is quite insane, but it's something that they can sell to people who are attracted to egalitarianism. It's like, well, just progressing and things are getting better, and we'll talk about the Whig theory of history as soon as we start reading this. But the one of the things that is key to progressives being able to have so much control for 100 years now is that they have no end point. Everything's just progressing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, well, this is where we need to get to. And there's no, just one continuous struggle.
Yeah.
And that causes them to be able to stay in power, one, because they're speaking to people's egalitarian natures, which I would argue is been something that has been drilled into us in the West through government schooling, that, you know, we have to be egalitarian. And then you think about Murray Rothbard's egalitarianism as a revolt against nature, where he talks about how it's just, that's not who we are. It's who we've been taught to be, but it's not who we are at our core. And he who controls the narrative, basically, to sum this up, he who controls the narrative controls everything.
Yeah.
And we see that now. The left controls the narrative, and that's why they're in charge. So I've been saying since the beginning of COVID, since March 2020, we have to come up with a better narrative. And the thing is, we also need to be able to get it out there. And unfortunately, the left, you know, spent a century taking over the press and taking over the academy. And now they have big tech. So getting a narrative out there is really tough.
Well, yeah, it's not just that. There is also the sort of methodological process of it, whereby you are both sort of looking backwards and looking forwards and attempting to construct what is, in a sense, an ideological continuum from one end to the other that justifies both previous actions and future actions. And it's not, you know, not even to necessarily comment on the value of whether or not that's a virtuous thing to do. And the way that one would understand political theory or elite theory, it's a necessary thing to do. You have to have, you know, some sort of animating spirit through a political formula, and one of the most powerful ones you can tap into is one that's historical. I will also just say, before I forget, to thank all the usual members of the channel and whoever else, and that there is also the Streamlabs link down in low or below as well if anyone wants to donate. Along with that, there should be the link for the text that we're reading from, and it's page 502 in the PDF. There's a little point that splits the chapter in half. Should we just sort of, I was going to say we can maybe just kind of crack on, but I think maybe one point, in case I forget to mention it, is that so much of where a Pinker or a James Lindsay goes wrong is that they completely separate God from the tradition of liberal ideas. And, you know, so much of that, especially the scholastic sort of precursor to what we then recognise as, you know, English or French or whatever other sort of liberal theory, was almost purely written in a completely theological context. It wasn't attempting to really discuss political theory. It was more suggesting, you know, what is natural law and what are the rights of man under God. And it was only then that relation, you know, from God to king and the creation of sort of divine right of king and whatever else, that the whole idea sort of comes together. But to recognise that the whole tradition is imbued with the idea of God the whole way through it.
the Enlightenment, you know, really did try to take that out of, remove that. I mean, but the problem is you're not going to remove it from men.
Mm.
So you can have this grand idea coming out of the Enlightenment, still men are going to put their beliefs into it. That's why the whole idea of theology, as like Burnham describes it, you know, I asked Curtis Yarvin recently, because from reading Burnham, I deduced that he believed that ideology, strict ideology, was for the plebs, was for the people,
mm-hmm.
you know, thinkers and elites. They understand that ideology is for the plebs and for the people, and yeah, they're always going to use it against them.
The show of I'm the most ideologically consistent is actually you screaming about how tight the shackles are around you.
So it's the coming out of the Enlightenment, coming into what we call liberalism now. And I mean, I don't, when I say liberalism, I include what they call classical liberalism in it. The marketplace of ideas, that kind of what I would have argued for 3 or 4 years ago. But now what I understand is the reason why we have, you know, pedophilia being people trying to normalize it, and why we've had so many.
It's interesting you say that, though, because the marketplace of ideas seems to just kind of pop up out of nowhere. Really, you know, there is someone like a John Locke who, even for all his faults, was quite open about the fact that he felt that liberalism was only really for white Christian men, and that that's who these rights were for, and that people that were arguing against liberalism from without its own framework, to them, he'd already previously disregarded. Now, whether or not he did that just because it was easy to argue, we still need to recognise that that was a, you know, it wasn't as pluralistic in the sense that the free marketplace of ideas, where you just have to have state-guaranteed free speech, in a sense. You know,
that's what we got. Mm-hmm. That's what we came to. We came to, it evolved into what I talk about is where, you know, are we going to, if you have a society that is allegedly built on individual liberty, and you have this, you have a constitution that guarantees, you know, says we're going to hand this down to our children, yet people start teaching the ideas of the French Revolution, or they start teaching the ideas of Marx, do you allow that? Because those lead you quickly away from the ideas of what they're talking about, liberalism.
Yeah.
I mean, it quickly, so they're talking about liberalism. They're saying, we'll have the rights to do this, this, this. These are all, let's lay out the rights for people, and they're all negative rights. Then they don't suppress ideas that take those away, that make those obsolete.
Well, that's why I stipulated state-guaranteed free speech, because what it is, much like civil rights, is actually the stripping of the ability of the individual to declare that they won't have speech on a subset of a property, or you won't put that sign up. You know, that ability is just completely removed. Which is, again, it's in the case of the civil rights, it's not that everyone is now free to go where they please, it's now that you're forced to go where you please, and if you don't want people to go where they please amongst your own grounds, then you're not allowed to do that. Your discrimination is essentially made illegal at that point, and the same for speech.
I've said, to me, the libertarianism basically comes down to two things, you know, what do you own, what do I own, and how do we prove it, and freedom of association. And I'm happy with both of those.
Yes. Right. For the sake of not taking all evening, shall we crack on?
Yes, let's go.
Right. As I said, he's gone through, for those who watched the previous part or haven't yet, they can pause this, go and watch it. We'll be back in not live time to hear to tell you the rest, but it's all there. With this, I have reached the stage of conceptual analysis and of historical insight and background information allows me, as my second task, to comment in some detail on the most recent attempt by Steven Pinker, with his book The Better Angels of Our Nature, to give new impetus to the Whig theory of history, i.e., the myth that human history has been a somewhat rocky but nonetheless steady march upward and into the light, and what we in the Western world live, if not in the best of all possible worlds, in a world better than anything that came before. Such a long sentence. Blasted mm-hmm. Hopper. The book, unsurprisingly, has been enthusiastically greeted by the ruling elite and become a commercial success, further boosted undoubtedly by Pinker's status as a charismatic Harvard professor. In 800 pages of small print, Pinker assembles a huge mass of interesting pieces of information and interpretation concerning all sorts of things. As far as the case he makes for some steady social progress culminating in the present, my verdict is entirely negative. Pinker may be an excellent psychologist, that's probably not even true, because he doesn't believe in like evolution above the neck. But he's out of the depth in areas of philosophy, methodology, economics, and history, which all are required to pass sound judgment on the degree of social perfection in the perfection of the various stages and long-run developments of man's or human history. I'll slow myself down because I'm tripping before. In particular, his historical narratives are frequently strike as cherry-picked, and either missing the wood for the trees or vice versa, but more often the trees for the wood. There's plenty to complain about in the book, not least the fact that Pinker is less than careful in unambiguously defining his terms, so as to avoid all internal inconsistency or equivocation. Here, however, I shall concentrate my criticism on only two central points. First, Pinker's measurement or criterion of social progress, his explanandum, and then his explanation for the so-measured phenomenon, his explananus. In the fact that he uses those phrases there, these different bits of Latin, you can tell instantly he's not talking to someone that's just read about John Locke, and he's talking to people who are, in a sense, you know, social scientists proper almost, who are able to look through society in such an analytical lens as he has here. Where he's picking apart the very nature of the argument that Pinker's using and trying to show why it's wrong in a very sort of steel man kind of sense, which I don't know, I quite enjoy it. It's something you don't really get elsewhere with a lot of stuff. It's almost only ever something you see in something like Mises' work.
I know this is really elementary to the conversation and everything, but when he says here the book unsurprisingly had been enthusiastically greeted by the ruling elites, oh, of course it does. If you subscribe to the Whig theory of history where everything is just getting better, at one point man couldn't live past 20, and now we're living in this paradise and it's only going to get better, of course the elites are going to love that, because then no one's rebelling. No one's questioning what they're doing. Everybody's just sitting back and waiting to see what genuine, what advances come next and how quickly we're going to get to utopia.
But that's a thing that so many libertarian people and liberals, and I think so many even conservatives fall for, is that they buy the narratives that he's talking about prior, where, implicitly pure material progress or pure technological process or social progress in a very sort of singular form, as Pinker is about to look at it. If you believe that, then no matter what your criticisms of the current regime are, you are still in a sense saying that the current regime and its preceding governments is responsible for the best time in human history, at which point you're really undermining your own arguments.
Yep.
There isn't... if you want to do this paragraph, I might just flash an image up quickly when you're reading through.
Sure. Throughout his entire work, Pinker shows a remarkable hostility toward religion, and hence it is hardly surprising that it does not cross his mind to use the biblical commandments, which incidentally he grossly misrepresents, as a benchmark for social perfection. Rather, his benchmark is violence, and social progress is defined as a reduction in violence. Yarvin talks about that as well. Yarvin talks about violence as being a benchmark too. first sight, this criterion does not seem too far away from the biblical liberation goal of peace. In fact, however, it turns out to be something quite different. His prime examples of violence are homicides and war casualties. The book is filled with tables and statistics on these indicators of violence. Incredibly, however, Pinker does not make a categorical distinction between aggressive and defensive violence. The biblical commandments, with their explicit recognition of the sanctity of private property, such a distinction is made. It makes a difference if violence is used to take another man's property or if a man uses violence in defense of his property against an aggressor. Murder is a categorically different thing from the killing of someone in self-defense. Not so for Pinker.
Yeah, I think the point you were making about Moldbug, I think he looks at non-violence in the same way that Mises comes up with the term cooperation, just insofar as the fact that if you have the founding elements of society of recognizing that we are not even necessarily individualism, but recognizing that there are other people and that other people own property, then to not dispute over property is generally a better state than to dispute over property. I think that's, which is a much more technical definition than the one that Pinker is using here. Or as Hoppe is describing Pinker's method.
There is a distinction where Moldbug believes in property rights. I don't know that Pinker would be as hardcore on property rights that, as that.
That'll come up in a moment.
Okay, all right. But there
was the... In the same way that he was discussing in the first part how economic historians go wrong, because Pinker is looking through this very basic sort of utilitarian lens, he then looks at a society only as one product, and that is the general level of violence as he goes on to define it. And he's no longer looking at the actual social rules or sort of preconceived cultural axioms, however you want to look at it, that then determine the behaviour in this society, which is the previous point Hoppe's trying to make, is you can't just look at the results, you've got to look at the system that produced the results. Because non-violence, as much as many people wouldn't want to believe it, isn't, in the sense that Pinker's looking at it, a natural state of man. Man is always under some sort of threat from his environment. Even if it's a misperceived threat and it's only psychological, it's still there in some sense. So for you to feel that you're in a sense of or space of non-violence, you have to have a sort of social conduct that produces that state. In the same way that freedom is only the product of people who are actually high trust and have responsibilities, they are only free within that aspect. You can't just give freedom to people who, in a sense, haven't gone out to earn it.
Agreed. They, yeah, I mean, I wasn't seeking to say that what Moldbug talks about when he talks about violence has anything to do is derived from the same place.
Mm.
Just saying that I was
bringing it up as an example to show the distinction. That Pinker's he's just looking at numbers. He's not looking at a qualitative aspect of society that produces non-violence as a result.
Let's keep going. We'll get into it now.
Yeah, property and
property and
on you go.
You want me to keep going?
Yeah, on you go.
Property and property rights do not systematically figure in his analysis. Indeed, the terms do not even appear in the book's 30-page subject index. For Pinker, violence is violence, and the reduction of violence is progress, regardless of whether this reduction is a result of a successful suppression of a people by and vis-a-vis another conquering people, or the result of their own successful suppression of aggressors and conquerors. York, famously before COVID, had reduced their murder rate insanely. I mean, basically the city got cleaned up.
Mm.
They did it by putting two cops on every other corner. I mean, New York City has 42,000 cops.
Mm.
So basically they put an army on the street and said, so go ahead, commit violence and we're going to kill you.
I mean, I'm not necessarily against it. Maybe just the techniques could be refined.
Well, pragmatically, sure. I mean, if that's the, you need to do that because that's the nature of the environment, sure. But that's not taking into consideration what the environment is and how it can be changed. What would be the best for it? I mean, the fact that how much it costs to live there, and I mean everything, all of those things need to be taken into consideration. Having one block, people who have 8 figures in the bank account, and the next block, people have nothing. I mean, you're kind of setting yourself up for a disaster.
Yeah, no, I like the point that Hopper makes here, where it's, he's saying that Pinker makes no mention of property rights, not even like a James Lindsay, where he mentions one bit of David Hume and a little bit of John Locke, and then pretends he's tied to the liberal tradition. Pinker doesn't even pretend. The concepts of property, ownership, catalactic trade, or anything like that has nothing to do with the way he sees the world in any sense, or at least the one he's projecting in this title, which is why you end up with this sort of almost bizarre, as what Carlyle would refer to as Benthamy utilitarianism to it, which Hopper then picks on with the example here. In Pinker's world, a stable master-slave relationship is a sign of civilization, while a slave revolt accompanied by violence is a sign of de-civilization. Likewise, a system of compulsory taxation, another term which, like property, is completely missing from the index, not coincidentally, is an indicator of civilization regardless of the height of taxation, as long as it is simply stable, i.e., as long as the mere threat of punishment by the tax authority is sufficient to achieve general compliance on the part of the taxed. Any tax revolt and resistance is to count as de-civilization. One is peace and progress to Pinker, whereas the other is violence and aggression. Pinker does not follow his own logic to the bitter end. This must be done to fully reveal the full depravity of his thought. According to him, a smoothly run concentration camp, for instance, guarded by armed men who do not murder the inmates and in fact prevent them from killing each other, but who simply supply them with happiness drugs, keep them quietly working for the benefits of the guards until their natural non-violent deaths, is the perfect model of peace and social progress, with a violent overthrow of guards by the inmates as well. Violence and decivilization. Very Ted-pilled point. And also one that I keep trying to explain to people is almost perfectly mapping on to Paul Gottfried and Sam Francis' idea of the therapeutic state. The general notion that not only, man can't be perfected, but he can at least be perfected to fit into the system.
And you wonder, part of progressive ideology is that man can be perfected. You have to wonder how many of the social engineers, the real people, the people who are actually pulling the strings, who we probably will never know their names, actually know that and would be like, okay, well, cannot perfect man, but look at all these SSRIs that we have.
Oh, wait till they start putting chips in people's heads. Because I've started reading a lot of Alul now. I've just cracked into the Technological Society, and I think within it's within a dozen pages, he essentially brings up the idea of a global soft concentration camp, and he has this whole sentiment of Hitler essentially drooling over it.
Charles Haywood from the Worthy House, he believes that's all just BS. Believes all the stuff they say about AI is BS. He believes all the stuff they're talking about chips in people's heads is all BS. He thinks it's just garbage. And the author too, Chris Knowles, who talks a lot about he very Jay Dyerish, talks about esoteric knowledge in Hollywood, how Hollywood basically created the modern serial killer. He believes the same thing. He's just like, this is all stuff that he says. I was told that I was going to have jetpacks. Yeah, he's 56 years old. He's like, I was told I was going to have jetpacks in 1982. Where are these jetpacks? Where are all these promises of this technology?
I'm not
Because
saying
the
that.
only technology that we seem to have that keeps seem to growing is like information technology. But as far as, you know, and he points out they can't even go to the moon anymore.
Mm.
So it's like, I mean, is this real? And I think it's not something to argue now, but it's definitely something to think about. It's something to maybe look up a couple people who talking about how this is all a lie. This all could be people just being like, hey, keep sending me money so that I can keep the people want this.
This is ideally why I was actually going to contact Steppy. However, I think you would probably be up for this as well, to essentially have a sort of discussion on cryptocurrency as a wider aspect of like an entire digital sort of free market social credit score system, and just, you know, discuss the whole notion of essentially a mass digitization of all aspects of society that might just completely go pop. And the, you really are getting into the sort of realities that Kaczynski is talking about there. And even something that Hopper briefly mentions in the previous section, where he distinguishes between handwork and mund work, you know, the actual physical interaction you have to do with nuts and bolts before you can begin to do the mathematics of what incline, you know, how to study inclined planes. So that, you know, you can have all this study of the maths, but if you can't do the physical engagement with the things, then you're no longer dealing with science you can verify, which is why so much of the technological developments appear to be so differing, but it's innovation only in one direction, because they've not had a changing set of conditions to actually study.
Vaughn.
Yep. Would you like to go, or shall I?
Go ahead. Keep going. I'll jump in after.
Based on this depraved view of social progress that knows no property and property violations, but only counts the number of unnatural deaths, bodily injuries, and broken bones, it should be expected that Pinker's evaluations in various historical episodes must yield some rather awkward or even grotesque conclusions, as in fact they do. In particular, it also explains how Pinker could misrepresent the present democratic age as the best of all times. Like, you know, you could probably just sum this all up by just saying that Pinker's just like Jeremy Bentham, but modern and more gay. But is it even on Pinker's own terms? Are we living today in the least violent of times? The answer is ambiguous. On the one hand, there are wars which throughout history have always been responsible for the largest number of casualties, far outweighing those resulting from regular, small-scale interpersonal violence. In this regard, as Pascal Cirillo and Nicholas Taleb shown in response to Pinker's progression thesis, no statistically discernible trend can be established. According to Taleb, for the 600-year period from about 1500 to today, for which we have relatively reliable data, no significant change to the frequency of war or the number of war casualties always set in relation to the total population can be made out. Indeed, if anything, there's been a slight uptick in war-related violence with the spread of democracy, contrary to the proponents of the so-called democratic priest theory. And as for the 70-year period since the end of World War II, which Pinker identifies as exceptionally peaceful and warless, Taleb points out that wars, and especially large-scale wars, are highly irregular and comparatively rare events, and that an observation period of just 70 years then is far too short to serve as a basis for any far-reaching conclusions. There was a point here that we ended up discussing with, me, Trigg, and Scrump were talking with Prudentialist, and we sort of almost looked at how the centralization of the state on varying levels goes hand in hand with a more totalizing sort of war, which kind of lines up with us all quite nicely. But it's more just an excuse to mention that, really.
Total state goes towards empire as well, because after you get your homeland under control, you have to spread it out. And in many cases, and in the case of the United States, the argument could actually be made that that was done even before, that they wanted to get control of as many foreign places as possible, starting, you know, in the 1900s, basically, and then work it inward home. You know, that's, I think a lot of that's what we're seeing. I think the war on terror, quote unquote, is probably the end of warfare, is the end of like mass scale, like wars of, looking for the proper word, theoretical wars, a war against an idea.
Mm.
Whereas, well, yeah, now...
I was going to say, that's where we ended up going the other week, where we, I sort of almost posited the kind of theory that since about World War One, there has only been one real global power, and that is America, providing it always has NATO or the League of Nations or whoever the UN's backing, so that it's necessary that they have to have ideological wars where there used to be national wars, and the only ideological wars you got in the past were maybe the Crusades, religious wars. But even then, they didn't take on the same sort of totalizing and ultimately sort of mass cultural phenomenon that something like the Cold War did, which in a certain sense, if you understand, as I like to, that communism as a political force wouldn't exist without American involvement in the early 20th century, they have to come up with a fake enemy, in a sense, to keep the whole thing going, and it has to be an ideological war. So it has to be that, so, totalizing, not just in the sense that it's a large scale, but that it dominates so many aspects.
Considering the last 2 years, they've basically declared war, like started war on health.
Mm.
I don't know that I'm trying to... As I sit here, I'm trying to figure out an existential idea they could go to war with on
the next
foreign policy wise.
The next one that comes is when the aliens arrive. Bluebeam. We know this.
They arrive doing what?
Bluebeam?
Oh, Bluebeam. Bluebeam. Okay, yeah.
I don't even explain Bluebeam to people anymore. I just expect folk to know. And if you don't know when it happens, I'm sorry, but you can go to... You can go to the wall and Mecca and all that and go pray to the fake hologram cubes in the sky, because I'm not doing it. I just always love the idea of, like, all the conspiracy theorist people for decades and decades have been like, the UFOs, the UFOs, the UFOs, and then they finally show up and they're like, those ones aren't real, though. But as John Gray has argued contra Pinker, even this assessment of modern times is likely too rosy a picture, because it tends to systematically underestimate the number of war-related casualties among non-combatants, i.e. the number of civilians dying from various diseases spread through war and long-term side effects of war, such as slow death caused by economic deprivation and starvation. The same danger of underestimation does not exist, at least not to the same extent, the wars of the European Middle Ages, because they were typically small-scale, territorial-restricted events, and involved a comparatively sharp distinction between the separation of combatants and non-combatants.
Also, they couldn't print money, so they were limited in what they could do. There was only so much money that somebody else was going to lend to them, the Vatican.
Oof. Just the Vatican, eh?
Well, yeah, I'm not going there. I don't want to get your channel taken down.
Oh, it's all right. We use all the sources from... Oh, I say his name all the time and now I've forgotten. Can't believe. That's really disappointing. Anthony C. Sutton. We use a lot of his stuff and he drops lots of names. And I don't think he means to be naming them, but he do be naming them. On the other hand, there exists indeed plenty of empirical evidence to speak of a super-secular trend towards a reduction in violence, not to be confused with a reduction in infringements on property rights, as measured in particular by homicide rates. A homicide is a homicide regardless of whom kills whom, why or how. In this extra amoral sense, we can indeed speak of a civilizing process, as Pinker does, and demonstrates in great detail, Pinker adopts this term from Norbert Elias in his book The Civilizing Process, first published in Germany in 1939 and translated into English 30 years later. In this book, Elias describes and aims to explain the changes in everyday etiquette from table manners to sexual mores that occurred during the European Middle Ages and since. Put briefly, this process can be described as a gradual transition from brutish, gross, crude, boorish, bearish, immodest and intemperance behaviour to increasingly refined, controlled, considerate, modest and temperate human conduct, taken as cuter. See, I don't even agree with that theory. People are pigs nowadays. Go to like any shopping center, like food court, and sit around for an hour and just watch the people that hover around and what they do. And this theory here is completely debunked as far as I care.
I don't even like to go out in public anymore. I mean, I'm just I'm not even kidding.
We need the gated communities. This is we need to tap into. Taking his cues from Elias, Pinker merely generalizes and expands Elias's civilizing thesis from human etiquette to all of everyday life and behavior. And in this, in my judgment, he's by and large successful. However, Pinker's explanation for this extra or amoral form of social progress from British to increasingly refined behaviour is fundamentally mistaken. What he identifies as the principal cause of this development, and I'll come to this cause in a moment, has actually, if anything, retarded and distorted this development. That is, absent Pinker's cause, there would have been not less, but more, and a significantly different refinement in human conduct. In fact, the grand long-run historical tendency toward increasingly refined or less British behaviour can be explained simply enough as the quasi-natural byproduct of the widening and deepening of the division of labour in the course of economic and technological development. Development of increasingly more and different productivity-enhancing tools and instruments proceeded hand-in-hand with the development and increasingly differentiation of human crafts, skills and talents. I like how he's describing here in a positive sense almost, or an analytical sense, division of labour and the innovation of technology, but he's also subsequently talking about the exact inverse of what Kaczynski refers to in the Power Process.
When you were reading this, the first part of this paragraph, I just thought of Ted. Yeah, I literally just thought of Ted. It's like, well, and also you can make the argument, well, why is there less violence? Because people are so busy.
Yeah, no, exactly. They're cucked. They're working to a clock. They have shifts for a job they have to turn up to. They can't afford to be violent, not because they don't want to pay the consequence of like getting their arse kicked. It's because they don't want to pay the consequence of losing material worth. Which is would be self-evident to most people, but when you understand it in that distinction, it's it's because they can't, by the nature of the way that society is regulated, it is poo-pooed upon to actually exercise violence to solve your problems, irrespective of whether or not you are performing any real justice in doing that. Put briefly, the importance of muscle power for economic success declined relative to the importance of brain power, physical finesse, and mental agility. Moreover, as I've tried to explain in A Short History of Man, especially under Malthusian conditions which prevail for most of human history, a systematic premium for economic success and indeed human survival is placed on the progressive development and growth of human intelligence. Low time preference, impulse control, and patience, which personal characteristics are at least partially hereditary and thus passed on through subsequent generations. See, I'm beginning to think that the relationship between there's Malthusian age and the post-Malthusian or industrial age, I think that's there is then another set of conditions that we are stepping into now that's because of the nature of how technological everything is. To look at the way that Elul almost looks at sort of class, where it's not dependent on wealth or necessarily power, but your ability to engage in technique, as he saw, or your expansive technological knowledge and rearranging mass society. I think that's something I don't know, I get a lot out of from Francis as well, which really adds an interesting spin and another axis on what Hopper's kind of talking about here.
Want me to keep going? Want me to continue with it?
If you were to go for a few, yeah.
Is it, we're at Pinker's explanation?
Yep.
Pinker's explanation for this tendency toward a progressive refinement of human conduct is a very different one, however. His explanation for this development is the institution of a state, i.e. a territorial monopolist of ultimate decision-making. He claims that the most decisive and all-important step in the progressive refinement of human conduct has been the transition from a stateless social order to a statist society. In this, he is not entirely wrong, given that his definition of progressive refinement is an extra or amoral one. Certainly, the institution of states, and more specifically of democratic states, is the principal cause of many central features and observations concerning our present-day human conduct and routines, except to notice that many or most of them have little or nothing to do with moral progress and stand in open contradiction to biblical commandments. As well, violence, as defined by Pinker, may indeed have gone down, except to notice that the exercise of violence has been so refined and redefined under state auspices as to no longer fall under Pinker's narrow definition of the term. Which is for those, you want good.
Just that section there is kind of like he almost perfectly falls for the several prevailing political myths to a certain extent that someone like Juvenal would talk about in On Power. You know, he's essentially drawing a demarcation point on some certain level of societal centralization and going, right, that's the state, that's where it all becomes good. And obviously because then he does this in the Enlightenment period, that's where that association and correlation with the two end up coming about. Sorry.
Talking about the transition from a stateless social order to a stateless society, it's when do we have a stateless society? Yeah. What is he talking about, stateless? I mean, I guess somebody like James Scott would say that we really don't have a modern state until the 1700s when you have systematic taxation. But then you have other scholars who will say, well, we've had states for 10,000 years. And so it's like, I guess it's very hard with, the people who get the history books, because how do we know we weren't there 1,000, 2,000, 2,500 years ago to know how, Egypt under the pharaohs, how violent that was. I wouldn't call that stateless.
Well, yeah, see, that's the kind of thing. Once you strip yourself away from what are ultimately ideological terms of state and non-state, which tend to not really be a difference of distinction. It's normally just degree, which when you try and mention that to anarchists, it blows their head up that they don't actually believe in a distinction. They just believe in a different set of hierarchical structures, if they believe in hierarchy at all, which is a completely different issue. But that's...
They don't believe in hierarchy at all, I don't really have a conversation.
Once you recognize that power is, not just power, but power disparities are a natural element of man's nature, or sorry, it is just man's nature to be unequal in power to one another in varying aspects. You know, especially going back and reading things like Carlyle, and then even further back, Robert Filmer's Patriarcha, which is an almost response to Locke's Second Treatise. He's not even necessarily like stepping into the ground of liberal political theory, which was only in its fledgling state at the time, because he's not even beginning to suggest that like there's a state, there's not a state. To him, there was always the patriarchs, and then there was the kings or the heads of the tribes and the kings, and at no point was there never not someone who was ruling over another person. And from that, he doesn't then derive that, oh well, man in his natural state must be free. Because he almost says in a response to Hobbes at the time, that like, well, when were men ever in this state of nature? Even in the Garden of Eden, they were subservient to God. So,
I mean, it's, and one thing that I've taken to telling people who believe in Ancapistan, things like that, is, well, there's going to be a natural hierarchy there as well. And that is something that a lot of them just can't deal with, because a lot of people have been taught that man is an island, and man can survive on his own, and maybe Ted seems to do pretty good, but if you're talking about a society, we live in a society, then there is going to be hierarchy is just natural. Power is just natural. There are going to be people with, it's just a matter of what they believe, how they were educated, what are their intentions. That's really what it comes down to. Yeah, I know I'm getting into great man theory here, but...
So I'm happy to hear it. Again, this is what I think I'd said to you, the phrase before, you know, that the part of this essay is almost Hopper channeling Carlyle. And I know Moldbug does the whole Mises to Carlyle thing, but I think, you know, his direct reference to a strict use of the commandments is a measure for social perfection. Even though that's really an autistic way to look at it, I think someone like Carlyle would at least appreciate the spirit of what he's trying to do there.
Sure. And, you know, he's Hoppe using the commandments makes sense if you know the commandments and you understand what he's talking about. I mean, property rights are right in the commandments, and everything that is needed... I've never talked to Hoppe about this, but I assume that he believes that everything in the commandments is what is needed to have a functioning community.
Well, he just says in general, what would appear on the face of them as minor points, but those who don't pay reverence to their elders, what sort of society do those people produce? Not one that's worth living in. So that's why, you know, he says you can't just focus on one of these elements. You've got to take them all as a holistic view. And again, it really shows where he's looking at a much bigger picture, and Pinker's just looking at one, you know, one little aspect of that a society produces, and completely disregarding this holistic view of what it lives up to in its terms of its values.
Let me go. So I'm going to go back and read the last sentence and then go on.
Yeah.
Well, violence as defined by Pinker may indeed have gone down, except to notice that the exercise of violence has been so refined and redefined under state auspices as to no longer fall under Pinker's narrow definition of the term. Witches, for instance, are no longer violently burnt, but shipped off instead, seemingly peacefully, into psychiatric wards to be drugged and pacified by medical professionals. And neighbors are no longer robbed of their property violently, but much refined and apparently without any physical violence, presented with regular recurring tax bills to be quasi-automatically paid per bank transfer into the accounts of the state. Central cause for social progress and increasing social perfection that Pinker identifies, then, instituting of a state, actually turns out to be a central force of decivilization, retarding and distorting the underlying civilizing process naturally set in motion by the deepening and widening of the division of labor in the course of economic development. Institution of the state may explain the refinement of violence in the course of time, but it is itself a constant source of violence, however refined, and the driving force for its expansion and intensification. Subtitle of Pinker's book, "Why Violence Has Declined," would lead most potential readers to expect an answer to be a moral question or problem because of the typically negative of the term violence. As such, the book's title is an ingenious attempt at false and deceptive advertisement, because Pinker does nothing of the sort. Instead, he answers the very different question of how to technically or scientifically define violence so as to make the morally most depraved and violent institution of all appear as a peacemaker, to make Satan look like an angel.
Just, I mean, he does have a way with words, the old hands, so... I just like the example at the top he has. You could look at that and maybe it could be argued as cherry picking, but you know, the example that Pinker is looking at and some of the data is the institution of the state over the space of 600 years in Europe, where he wants to solely look at the state as the as the main factor for producing whatever social progress. Now, Hoppe is suggesting that there are other elements producing this social progress, and it's possible maybe that because of the length of time that these two factors are working against each other, for most of that time, and maybe up until recently, the forces that produced social perfection, we're actually still working, worked, you know, even against the forces of the state that through some sort of disperfection or whatever you would want to call it. Whereas if you were to look at an example where a state was rapidly instituted in somewhere like China or Russia or Cambodia, you know, all of a sudden you're looking at a completely different kettle of fish. You know, the instituting of the state in China killed how many tens of millions, who really knows? So for that to then be, you know, for him to say that this is the thing that stopped violence in the case of China, it's almost laughable that you could make that argument.
He has to cherry pick who he's going to use as an example, as scientific, because, you know, he tries to make this so scientific by using statistics and charts and things like that. But I like that Hoppe uses technically or scientifically to show that this is junk science on his part. He's taking in the evidence that he wants, and he's leaving out the evidence that is going to hurt his cause.
And there is also an irony that he is then forced into such a corner, because if he was to argue about any other aspect of what makes the West and why it has progressed so far, you would maybe have to argue about something to do with biology or religion or soil or a mixture of the three, or the culture that these three things then produce, which becomes a completely different question from, does a silence produce violence, or does a society produce violence or not?
I mean, he doesn't talk about the fact that there are states in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, that are states, and they're and it's legitimate, but they're violent, they're poor, why is there violence in these states? He can't answer these questions because he's not willing to go outside of the very, very narrow box and the very, very narrow amount of evidence he is going to use to make his claim.
Mm-hmm. And how does he do this? First, by throwing out logic and plain common sense, and then fudging the data and historical narratives to fit his plain, nonsensical, basic premise. Pinker presents the basic premise in the form of a simple diagram in Better Angels of Our Nature, page 35, which I have here. Oh, that's not that one. That's one. Where he's got this wee triangle diagram thing, and, you know, there is some sort of conflict between two people, and this constitutes war. And as long as you have some third party that is, of course, neutral and acts as a bystander, that they then mediate this situation, which is basically just reading Marxist theory on the state backwards. In any two-person scenario, both parties may have a motive for violence, either as an aggressor to prey on the other victim, or to prey on the other, or as a victim to retaliate. Consequently, similar to Hobbes, Pinker pictures this state of affairs as one of interminable conflict, or violent conflict, as a bellum omnum contra omnes, a war of all against all. Which is, I think, it's something I, even going through very basic sort of liberal theory years and years ago, and starting to dabble in bits of Locke and this, that, the next thing, at no point did the argument, the Hobbesian argument, or even the sort of Rousseau kind of thing about of a war of all against all, that has never made sense to me at any point. I never understood this view that sees man as just like an animal that wouldn't be able to rationally understand why it would be better to cooperate as opposed to not cooperating.
That's just really not having, ignoring the fact that men are self-interested and the fact that men are like, what's his name? John C. Calhoun. John C. Calhoun, in his disquisition on government, talks about how the reason why governments exist, and it's basically the same reason, he uses the same reason that a lot of Austrian economists use for why laissez-faire economics would work: self-interest. because people are more self, people have self-interest, so they care about their neighbor, they care about themselves more than their neighbor. So if any kind of strife, if any kind of tension happens, they are going to choose themselves over their neighbor. And because that can turn into something very ugly, that's why we have instituted government to protect people's rights. And the something that I don't know that Pinker could even address, especially from like an economic standpoint, where talk about how laissez-faire economics could work because people are self-interested and they are going to, humans act basically. And why do humans act? Because it's in their self-interest. So, yeah, I don't think that, I wouldn't be surprised if Pinker doesn't even know the title of the book, Human Action. So,
True.
That would, if he read something like Human Action, maybe he could progress past this. I mean, somebody like Michael Rechtenwald was a
I honestly don't think he could, because he is, you know, I keep throwing the image up every once in a while of use him on MSNBC, his belief in God unsophisticated, he's just having a stupid fucking mug. But you know, he is someone who's devoutly unable to see value outside of the material. And I think to even understand Austrian economics and Misesian liberalism, you have to understand ideas as not just material concepts. You actually have to genuinely care for them in some sense to appreciate it. So I don't even think he'd really be capable.
He's operating on a very materialistic... He's operating on a... belief system is very materialistic. He doesn't see anything as metaphysical. And at this point in his life, his belief system is what is paying the bills. That's also very dangerous. You know, I mean, for the past couple of years, I have changed my opinion on a lot of things, and I've changed my message on a lot of things, and it has cost me. I mean, I'm one of these people who, I guess I wasn't making enough money that I was going to sell out and, you know, just keep preaching stuff that I don't believe, even if I didn't believe it. And my thinking had moved on. You know, I'm just somebody who is interested in truth and is constantly trying to find something new to hone my thinking on exactly, you know, what this world is, how it works, and, you know, how it works in theory and in practice, and how you can use that theory to maybe get something into practice. But somebody, you know, it's just like they say about the police. It's like, if somebody's feeding your family is based upon your belief system, you know, just like the police, I mean, it's going to be hard to change that mind.
If it was easy to be a genuine radical, everyone would do it.
So, I'm not calling myself a radical. I'm just saying that I'm way more interested in the truth than I am in being loved, being respected. I mean, I want to be respected. I want to be loved. But I mean, if me changing my mind on something causes somebody to abandon, I don't care. I'd rather believe that I'm on the path to real truth than have people out there just standing for me all day or something.
But miraculously, there is a cure to this problem. A third party, which Pinker calls a bystander, that acts as judge and assumes the role of a territorial monopolist of violence, so as to create, I would imagine there's maybe a two there, create a lasting peace. Would this bystander not also be a potential predator? And would his predatory motives not be even strengthened if he were the monopolist of violence and did not have to fear any retaliation from his victims? Pinker does not address these rather obvious questions, let alone provide a systematic answer to them. Nor does he provide an answer to the question of why anyone would submit himself without resistance to any such bystanding monopolistic judge. No one recognised the potential danger for his own property from such an arrangement and put up resistance against its establishment. Be sure, Pinker cannot help noticing later on that empirically, states qua territorial monopolists of violence did not emerge spontaneously or quasi-organically, but mafia-like, as some sort of protection racket. Yet this observation does not lead him to revise or reject his fundamental thesis about the principal role of the state as a peacemaker, nor does it lead him to the recognition that many, if not most, of the civilizing achievements he ascribes to the workings of the state are in fact the results of popular resistance against state power. Whether active and violent, or passive and non-violent, indeed as mentioned before, Pinker classifies any violent resistance against the state as decivilization, which implies that the prior violence exercised by the state vis-a-vis the resistor must have been a civilizing and pacifying activity, not to be counted as violence at all. It is almost needless to say that such mental acrobatics inevitably lead to various contradictions from which Pinker can extricate himself only through more or less ingenious but always intellectually painful contortions.
They always fall into that. I remember, what's that? What's the objectivist, the main guy, the guy with the lisp?
Oh, Yaron Brookes.
Yaron Brookes. His contradictions, I mean, he says he's an atheist, he's a materialist, and then like the next thing out of his mouth is so metaphysical, it's ridiculous.
Mm.
He's making a moral, he's making a morality claim.
Mm.
And it's like, okay, well, I mean, I don't know where that came from, you know, and I don't think you're going to try to use argumentation ethics to get there, but okay, so, you know, okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for being the most religious person on the on the panel.
You're a cool story, bro.
Want me to keep going?
Yeah, if you want to the next.
I don't think we need to comment on that. I think that was comment enough.
Yeah.
Pinker's identification of the state as the all-important force in the process of civilization coincides, of course, perfectly well with the assessment of all state rulers everywhere. It is essentially the very same lesson that we all have been taught in school and university to accept as a quasi-axiomatic truth. In particular, it is the same lesson taught by all contemporary leading economists. Yet it flatly contradicts one of the most elementary laws of economics. Production under monopolistic conditions will lead to higher prices and lower quality of whatever is produced as compared to the production of the same product under competitive conditions, i.e. under conditions of free entry. Most contemporary economists recognize this law, but they fail to apply it to the peculiar monopoly that is the state, most likely because most of them are employed by the state. I mean, that's it. I mean, Pinker has to have these opinions because this is what he relies on the state to exist and the state to be the all-powerful monopoly in order for him to keep going.
Well, the best part about it is he doesn't even need to be conscious of it, as long as he falls for, you know, almost what Ellul calls propaganda as a wider socio-psychological kind of phenomenon, whereby, you know, the entirety of mass media plus the conscious propaganda that's produced all acts to convince people that the current moment, that living right now in the present, is the best place that you can live. You know, and everything before it was crap, and everything that's coming after is going to be even better. Is once you've tapped into that general, you know, material arc of history in some sense, you make your analysis completely toothless, no matter what conclusion you can come up with. So you can be as critical as you want of state or lockdown policy or whatever else, but if you still believe in a base utilitarianism that looks at progress and public health and, you know, all of these post-19th and 20th century concepts, then there's no point. You might as well just shoot yourself in the foot.
It just needs to be adjusted.
Mm.
If you believe in that theory that things are just getting better, and then you have something like what happened over the last 2 years, well, that was but a mistake. We need better leaders, and that's basically what you hear. But the leaders are going to be chosen for you. So, I mean, you may have 20 leaders to choose from, but those 20 leaders are chosen. So, it's like I think Chomsky talks about where you're. you're allowed debate, but you know, you're only allowed to debate within these parameters.
I just love the very. Sorry, could I cut out there? I wasn't sure if you'd finished or not.
Bad.
No, I love the very simple logic of explaining to people. You know, if we were to take democracy as it's explained to us by the media, by the press, and whatever else, seriously, we couldn't, through democratic means, argue for non-democratic governance. Because if you don't believe in the values of a democratic mandate, then why do you need a democratic mandate to institute it? And then why would a democratic institution recognize that mandate? You know, by its own contradict, you know, it can't recognize a mandate for that, because then it's, you know, it's almost like an argumentation ethics kind of issue there of, well, what do you believe in here?
I'm going to keep going.
On you go.
But in fact, it applies to the state as well, regardless of how one describes the specific product that it produces. We describe the state, as Pinker does, as a territorial monopolist of peacemaking, then peace will be more expensive and of lower quality. Huh, that's interesting. That sounds like one of Andrew's laws of archotropism. We describe it as a monopolist of justice, then justice will be of higher cost and of lower quality. If we describe it as a monopolist of violence, violence will be more expensive and of worse quality. Or if we describe it, as I think best, as a territorial monopolist of expropriation charged with the task of property protection, then we will predictably get much expropriation, which benefits the monopolist, and little protection, which will be only costly for the state. In any case, the result is always the same, and Pinker's central thesis concerning the civilizing effect of the institution of a state then must be rejected on logical grounds alone.
No, I do always love the example that Hopper uses, where he treats it from even a very simple level of, well, if an insurance company that you had signed up for asked you to get rid of your ability to defend yourself, would you not possibly be concerned?
Do you want me to keep going? You want to pick up?
Yeah, I can carry on for a few. What about Pinker's empirical case then? Logic cannot be refuted by empirical data, but if one throws out logic, one is bound to misinterpret empirical data. Pinker offers a huge number of empirical data, tables, and graphs of great interest. I have quarrels with some of them, but here I accept them all for the sake of argument. My criticism concerns solely his interpretation of these data. In fact, and as mentioned before, I can largely go along with his generalized Elias thesis about a civilizing process from brutish to refined human conduct. Based on logic, however, I would interpret it differently. Whatever civilizing process there was, it did not occur because of the state, but in spite of, or in resistance against the state. And whatever decivilizing process there was, it did not occur because of the absence of a state, but in spite of its absence, or as the late lingering effects of a prior, now dissolved state, and its earlier decivilizing tendencies. Post hoc does not imply propter hoc.
I will use a very simple example that a lot of people in the States would understand. When you, and I've written on this pretty extensively recently, is when you go to a small town in America, there is usually complete order, and if you find crime, it's usually property crime, and it's usually being done by teenagers or something like that. They didn't need to be told that they needed to be civilized. They don't need these things. They have their own beliefs, they have their own system, and what they have more than anything is lack of a state. They do have a state, they do have police, they do have a town council, on top of other things. And to stick to the subject of this last paragraph, is they do not have a state constantly in their face telling them what they need to do. As a matter of fact, when you go to these small towns, and I've been to a lot of them, you find a hatred of that state. You don't find a hatred of country. You definitely find a hatred of the state. And that is because they have lived a certain way for a very long time. And there's undoubtedly there are other factors in there. It is one that you can clearly see. I mean, if people, I've said this, that if people want to experience a libertarian society, it's not going to be perfect. Nothing is ever going to be perfect to a small town in America.
Well, it's
picked to a particularly, you know, a particularly, you know, a wealthy one. You don't want to pick to one that pick one, pick a town that, or the, you know, the farms are having problems and they've been having problems for decades and everything. Those are becoming a little more evident. Were probably overblown in the 80s, but they're there.
I don't think it's just the state, though. I think there is also possibly technological involvement in these areas. Then, you know, if it's generally lesser, you will find a greater economic interdependence, because the person, you know, there's one person in the town that actually goes and milks a whole farm of cows, and that's where the town gets its milk from. And that through those interactions, there is actually a sense of trust that needs to be brewed. You know, it's not regulation that stops the guy that runs the, you know, dairy farm from putting poison in his milk. It's the fact that he also needs to buy bread and meat and get his car serviced and get his factory equipment serviced. So he needs to make sure that he's a respectable person that can go and get out, go out and get those services within his own community. And it was actually an interesting thing the other day, where I was arguing with crypto people, as I tend to do. And they were making the argument that it was a good thing that you don't need to trust someone when you use Bitcoin. And I found that almost a sort of like existential issue of like, wait, so you're investing something that actually breeds out trust as a human trait towards productive society. And they couldn't see that as an issue. I just think if you're trying to tap into libertarianism and living in a sort of an organic hierarchy that comes together in what's, you know, in a voluntary nature, as it were, then having parts of that infrastructure that don't require you to trust the people around you, it doesn't help produce that situation.
Which makes no sense, because anybody who knows anything about even the Bitcoin, the BTC blockchain, that it's a high trust community, especially people who that's not a good argument. that's a very poor argument.
Well, it's just the fact that they were arguing against wanting to trust people, and they couldn't see the contradiction there of believing in libertarian theory but not wanting to trust people.
I mean, you can make the argument that if the state had sound money, backed by something, that's not trust either. It would, that doesn't seem to, I mean, or is it only because Bitcoin is a certain technology?
To argue through the fact that, you know, you can't be chanced. So no one's going to be able to send you fake Bitcoin.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I don't know. I think that no matter what, trust is important. And you also, it's nice to know who you're dealing with.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, I'm not arguing anything. I know that most quote unquote criminal activity in the world happens with the US dollar still. That seems like a weird. A weird argument to make for.
I'll continue on here so not ages. I will restrict my criticism to two central exhibits that Pinker offers in empirical support of his thesis, one concerning global affairs and another a more regionally specific one that's mostly directed related to my earlier observations of European or Western history. The empirical support for the global progression thesis is summarized in two tables. I would have got these up, but the PDF's a bit crap, and he does a good enough job of describing them anyway, to be quite frank. The first is supposed to show the decline of war deaths as a percentage of population from human prehistory to the present. For this, Pinker distinguishes four historical stages: prehistory, hunter-gatherer societies, hunter-horticulturalist societies, and finally, state societies. He then provides data to show that there was at best only a minimal improvement from the highly violent prehistoric era to the hunter-gatherer stage. The violence increased again with the introduction of horticulture and agriculture, and there's then more economic inequality and more to loot. And it finally dropped off sharply to a level never before seen in human history with the introduction of state societies. To further bolster his thesis, the second table compares the rate of death and warfare from modern non-state societies of the 19th and 20th centuries with equally modern state societies. Sorry, grab a bit of water there, my voice is going. Supposedly demonstrating once more the civilizing effect of states. As I said before, I shall not quibble about the numbers and estimates presented in these tables, except to note that any estimate concerning human prehistory in the far distant hunter-gatherer horticulturalist stages of human history must be viewed with a good dose of scepticism. Archaeological findings of broken skulls, for instance, can provide a basis for some reasonable estimate of violence at particular places and times. You then may also scale up such estimates to the approximated total world population at the time to calculate the violent death rate for any given period. But what you cannot do, and what is for obvious technical reasons, at least until today, nearly impossible to do, is show that your sample of violence data is a representative random sample, from which alone it would be legitimate to generalise specific findings to the population total. Again, another one of these things that's a complex statistical point that he's making here, that basically 99% of people would never understand. You try and explain to someone the difference between like data and a representative random sample of data, you're just wasting your time. Which is when it's so easy to pull people, the wool over people's eyes, when the midwits read all this stuff, because they just don't grasp it. You want to carry on?
You want me to go? Yeah. The central reason, however, why Pinker's data fail to demonstrate what he wants to demonstrate is a different one. In his attempt to compare non-state societies with state societies, he is comparing what cannot be compared. His examples of non-state societies, whether ancient or modern, refer almost exclusively to some obscure tribes outside of Europe, or in a few rare European cases, to tribes living thousands of years prior to the Christian era. All of them have either literally died out or else left no lasting trace in history, in that it is nearly impossible today to trace any one contemporary society back to them genealogically as their historical predecessor. In distinct contrast, all the examples of state societies are taken from Europe and the Western world, where such genealogical backtracing is easily possible for periods of hundreds or even thousands of years. Obviously, such a comparison can yield an unbiased conclusion only under the assumption that the only relevant factor distinguishing European or Western people from Pinker's various tribesmen is the presence or absence of a state, and that otherwise both peoples are the same with the same physical and mental constitution endowment. It's literally what he's saying is, to make his point, is using data that can be relatively verified on the positive side. The negative side, he can literally just make stuff up.
this is also the point here that he is, you know, someone who is a big atheist, he's big into material science, but he isn't willing to look at, you know, evolution above the neck, as it were, in regards to societies and cultures, and even necessarily a predilection towards violence per se. I mean, he would never even begin to touch just collating that data, never mind arguing for it in any sort of positive sense. So it's just hilarious that, you know, it's no surprise he wrote a book called The Blank Slate.
Yeah. Anchor never explicitly states this assumption, crucial for his own case, probably because it would cast some immediate doubt on the validity of the conclusion. Indeed, as a matter of fact, there have been countless empirical studies in the meantime in many disciplines that demonstrate the utter falsehood of this assumption. Substantial differences exist in the physical and mental makeup and endowments of different people. Europeans, or more generally Westerners, are decidedly not the same sort of people that Pinker's tribesmen are. And with that, his first empirical proof of his progression thesis collapses. Non-starter and proves nothing. In addition, Pinker misses the trees of humans for the global wood of mankind in another regard, for according to his own data, there are also some non-state societies, even if only a few, that equal or even surpass the level of peacefulness achieved in state societies. As a brief aside, Pinker might not even be aware of the fact that some of the false human quality assumption is necessary to make his point, but he assumes it anyhow again and again, if only implicitly or surreptitiously. Deep down, Pinker is an egalitarian, as is particularly evident from his outspoken sympathy for the progress brought about by the so-called civil rights movement and the noble Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., as well as Nelson Mandela, quote, one of history's greatest statesmen, unquote, notwithstanding both men's well-known communist connections.
See, as given this idea that as long as you are, no matter how much terrorism you commit before you institute a state, because obviously at no point Pinker's going to be like, Nelson Mandela, good, but he did throw a grenade through a cafe window. You know, Lenin must be this guy's hero.
Well, I mean, really, at least, I mean, I guess Mandela won. But, you know, Lenin won. He defeated his enemies.
Yeah.
Mandela really didn't defeat his enemies. His enemies were still all around him. At least Lenin was able to suppress.
Yeah, just like this idea of Pinker instituting or making some argument that the Red Terror was actually like a great cause for humanity because in doing so it allowed the institution of the Russian Social Democratic State. I mean, imagine what he would say about the unification of Germany.
Jesus.
Just bumps along the road.
Yeah, oh, well. Sure, that's how are you going to get to utopia without bumps? Pinker is not an extreme and extremely silly egalitarian.
Sure, that's the thing about utopia, it's got a very bumpy sort of complexion to it.
Pinker is not an extreme, and then in parentheses, an extremely silly egalitarian, of course. Makes distinctions between sexes, ages, races, and classes, and he is well aware of the unequal distribution of various human traits and talents within society, of intelligence, diligence, impulse control, sociability, sociability, etc. As a politically correct progressive, he cannot bring himself to the recognition that the unequal distribution of these human traits and talents within society may be very different in different societies. With Pinker's first global empirical proof rejected, what about his second regional one? Here, all data come from Europe, and insofar the danger of comparing incompatibles is avoided. Pinker devotes some 10 pages 228 to 238, to this case, and the key information is condensed in a single graph, page 230, depicting the rate of death in conflicts in Greater Europe from 1400 to 2000. You said you didn't want to put that one up, right?
Sorry, it's just that they don't look the best, and you can get a general idea of what you're seeing anyway, which is that, you know, because he has this very scientific definition of violence, it's like, well, okay, but you're using the data that the states essentially put out, and in doing so, you aren't recognizing statist violence, as Hopper would refer to it, which is, it's just the different manners of methodological trickery he uses to negate that fact.
If anything, however, this graph demonstrates the opposite of Pinker's progress thesis. what it shows is that the longest period of relative peacefulness and low levels of violence was almost 200 years from 1400 until the very end of the 16th century. This period falls precisely within the longer period of the European Middle Ages and marks its end. The Middle Ages, as I have argued before, are a prime example of a stateless social order. And in parentheses, he puts, interestingly, Pinker concurs with this assessment of medieval Europe as stateless, but he then fails to see that it implies, according to his own data, an empirical refutation of his thesis. As it gets worse for Pinker's case, according to the same graph, the following historical period, from the late 16th century to the present, is characterized by three huge spikes in the level of violence. The first spike, from the late 16th century until the Westphalian Peace in 1648, is largely associated with the Thirty Years' War. Second, from the late 18th century until 1815, and somewhat less steep than the first, is associated with the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. And a third and greatest spike, from 1914 to 45, is associated with the 20th century's two world wars. As well, for all intermediate periods, the level of violence remained well above that of medieval times, a level that was only reached again three centuries later during the period from 1815 to 1914, and again during the post-World War II era. The record for post-medieval Europe in terms of violence appears rather depressive. And yet the entire period from the late 16th centuries until today is the era of states, which Pinker considers the driving force of a civilizing process.
But it's almost worse than that. It's not just the era of states, but these three specific spikes, you know, the 1648, around the 30 Years' War, 1815, you know, French Revolution, Napoleonic Wars, and then the period of democratization between the two world wars. Again, through the framework of someone like de Juvenal, we could understand these as key centralizing points from, you know, monarchy to republicanism to democracy. And at each pole or at each point there, the state then becomes a more totalizing force. So there's no wonder that there's this height of violence as it forces the society into the shape that it needs it to be to rule over it in the way that it wishes to. And it's kind of just funny that, you know, that process of centralization is what states do. That's the thing that makes them states. So the fact that those, when the state does that, even in Pinker's own data, that's the time at which it creates the most amount of violence, even by its own hand.
Also after the Protestant Revolution.
Hey. we'll not go into that here because that's a whole different conversation.
Yeah, that'd be a long one. We might want to bring some other people in on that one too.
I just think it's so funny though. I mean, you know, Pinker, and he is. I mean, how long must he have been writing and reading stuff now for? 20 odd years, nearly 30 years, and he's never come across the Juvenal and ever considered the fact that as the state becomes a more total and central entity in society, that allows it to produce more violence. I mean, I've not been reading stuff for decades and decades and decades, and I've come across that. So what's the difference here?
Well, it could be, as Hoppe describes here, is that he cherry picks his information. I mean, maybe he has read on power. It just doesn't fit into his worldview.
But even in the cherry picking example, you know, there is that direct correlation there that you could see, and it must just never come across them. It's kind of funny. Pinker associates the first drastic spike in violence with religion and the wars of religion, because of course he does. In fact, however, these were wars to make states. Feudal kings and princes aspiring to the rank of absolute ruler made war to bring increasingly larger contiguous territories under their supreme control. In this, they took advantage of the recent split within Latin Christendom between Catholics and Protestants, and it was they who actually invented the term wars of religion, if only to deceive and hide their real purpose of state-making, which had little, if anything, to do with religion. The second spike marks a turning point from monarchic to democratic states, and was the result of the Napoleonic France using the war in attempt to establish hegemony over all of continental Europe and Rothschild's money. And the third and most drastic spike in the level of violence marks the beginning of the era of full-fledged democracy and the result of Britain and the USA going to war to establish world hegemony. As interpretation of these data, Pinker tries to make the best out of, for him, a rather desperate-looking case. For one, he points out with the help of a second graph that throughout the entire period, the number of violent conflicts declined as the number of states fell due to territorial consolidation and centralisation. A greater number of small-scale wars with fewer casualties replaced with a smaller number of large-scale wars with many casualties. This does not appear much like progress, however, especially if it's kept in mind that the rate of death in conflicts actually increased over the entire statist era, even if the number of violent conflicts declined. The rescue is progress thesis, then, Pinker advances two auxiliary arguments. First, he claims that the more lethal character of less frequent, more modern wars has nothing to do with states per se, or with their territorial expansion and consolidation, but is instead the quasi-accidental result of advances in military technology. A thesis that he asserts that he elsewhere rejects when he states that the development of technology is essentially neutral to the level of violence. I do like that. When thinkers just refer to things as accidents, it's just that you have completely run out of road entirely. I think Rothbard makes the point quite often about a lot of other liberal or neoliberal sort of theorists, when it's like, well, the Rothschilds had all their money tied up in this, and then it went that way for them, and then they get rich, and then they ended up in power. Well, you know, it must just be a coincidence. And secondly, to add more weight to his thesis about the decline in the frequency of war, but not to emphasise again the decline of the war-related death rate, he points out that the process of political centralisation, i.e. the increasingly smaller number of states with increasingly larger territories, was not accompanied by a corresponding increase of civil or intrastate war, and hence represents a real civilising gain, and not just an accounting trick. Essentially, according to Pinker, with each political centralisation and ultimately the establishment of a world state, the likelihood of war declines and ultimately disappears, along with a parallel decline and disappearance of civil war. In short, states civilise and a world state civilises best, or in reverse, each secession decivilises and complete freedom of secession decivilises most.
How can he look at history and not see that the smaller, better? That's just such simple stuff, you know. But look at the Hanseatic League, or even the Italian states. When it comes down to it, he's just making an excuse for the size of this empire. And that is why the elites have no problems with his book. It goes back to that. You wonder why schlub like me can find books like Hoppe and others and see these things and at least be introduced to them, even if we don't embrace them. And he's so far out that he won't even, if he wanted to really steel man these arguments, which most people just don't want to do anymore, he could bring in like a Hoppe argument from Democracy, the God That Failed, and then seek to destroy it, but he wouldn't be able to. So he has to rely upon this.
Well, because he fundamentally believes that no one man is in any value sense different from the other, unless in very specific technical terms that are politically correct science.
Yeah. Though I assume he values himself above others.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Radical self-interest again. Want me to pick this up?
Yeah, if you want.
Economic logic, praxeology, dictates a very different interpretation of all this, however. States are not spontaneous voluntary associations. They are the result of war. The existence of states increases the likelihood of further wars because under status conditions, the cost of war making must no longer be borne privately, but can at least partially be externalized onto innocent third parties. The number of wars then declines as the number of states falls, and that there can be no interstate war once the number of states has been reduced to a single world state is not much more than a definitional truth. Even if less frequent, however, the further advanced the process of political centralization and territorial consolidation, i.e., the closer to the ultimate status goal of a world state, the more lethal such wars will become.
Well, this is kind of, we discussed earlier on, that you then have wars of ideology and ideas.
I mean, this is what the, you take Ayn Rand's objectivism to its logical conclusion, one world government.
Mm.
Because they say, well, we can't have competing police. You know, when you talk about like private policing, in like an anarchist kind of society, in a theoretical anarchist society where, you know, you'd have a private police force here and a private police force here, they immediately go to the fact that they would war against each other. It's not like they would talk to each other. It's not like they would, you know, like AT&T and Sprint talk to each other, you know, and are like, okay, well, if someone from a Sprint phone calls on an AT&T phone, calls an AT&T phone, they'll get the call. Well, it's not like they could possibly cooperate, would have to go to war with each other. Well, when you take that to its logical conclusion, you can't have one country that believes something and another country that believes something else. There's always going to be, there won't be reason. That's what, and I've actually had objectivists say to me that police exist to enforce reason.
See, in a certain sense, that's true, but only in a really mask-off, like almost like Maoist sort of sense would I agree with that statement. And most people are not Maoist objectivists.
So when it comes down, yeah, right. When it comes down, when it that would be great. Or is Aaron's a Misesian Leninist?
It's Hoppian Leninism. I'm gonna go for. I do like a little bit of Austro-Maoism though, Kaczynski characteristics.
But yeah, but then once you get them down to, it's like, well, you want a one world government. It's like, no, well, you know, we just want this country to be. Well, what about Canada? If Canada doesn't agree with that, how are you guys going to talk? There's always going to be strife, so it has to be a one world government, and you can say. You'll actually get some that'll be like, yeah, that's correct. So, yeah, it is a logical conclusion of their beliefs. Nor can the institution of a world state deliver what Pinker promises. True, there can then be no interstate wars by definition. For the sake of argument, we may even concede that the frequency and the casualty rate of the internal civil wars may decline as well, although the empirical evidence for this appears increasingly doubtful. In any case, however, can be safely predicted about the consequences of a world state is this: with the removal of all interstate competition, with the replacement of a multitude of different territorial jurisdictions with different laws, customs, and tax and regulation structures by a single worldwide uniform jurisdiction, any possibility of voting with one's feet against a state and its laws is removed as well. Hence, a fundamentally important constraint on the growth and expansion of state power is gone, and the cost of the production of justice, or whatever it is that the state claims to produce, will accordingly rise to unprecedented heights, while its quality will reach a new low. There may or may not be less of the broken bones type violence a la Pinker, but in any case, there will be more refined violence, i.e., property rights violations that do not count as violence to Pinker, than ever before, and the world state society then will look more like the stable concentration camp scenario mentioned earlier than anything resembling a free, convivial social order.
The global panopticon, as it were. (Clears throat) I'm gonna put, I don't know, are you still there or? The stream doesn't seem to have died on my end, so we'll see what happens. Bit of a shame if it was the end there. We're getting quite close to the end. But no, it sort of begins to show why Hopper comes up with the points earlier. He's suggesting that, you know, why is there no mention of property rights or of ownership? Because it's through the fact that you own yourself that you would have any dignity, and that you wouldn't subject yourself to the sort of scenario he describes here, where it's an SSRI fueled concentration camp. Yeah, I don't know. I've messaged Pete on Twitter. I will see if I get a response. If not, I shall continue on with the end of this myself here. Stripped down to its bare bones, Pinker's central argument amounts to a string of logical absurdities. According to them, tribal societies somehow merge to form small states, and small states successively coalesce into increasingly larger states. This merging and coalescing were, as the terms insinuate, a spontaneous and voluntary matter, however the result, by definition, would not be a state, but an anarchic social order composed and governed by free membership associations. On the other hand, this merging and coalescing results instead in a state. If on the other hand, this merging and coalescing results instead in a state, it cannot be a spontaneous and voluntary matter, but must, with logical necessity, involve violence and war, and that any territorial monopolization necessitates the violently enforced prohibition of free entry. But how then can anyone such as Pinker, who wants to reduce violence and war to a minimum, and possibly eliminate it entirely, prefer a social system, any system, that necessitates the exercise of violence and war to a system that does not do so? Answer: only in throwing out all logic, or all of logic, and claiming that the relationship between the state and violence and war is not a logically necessary one, but a merely contingent empirical relationship instead, that, just as it is indeed an entirely empirical matter whether or not you or I commit violence and go to war, so too it is a purely contingent empirical matter whether or not a state commits violence and goes to war. And this is the point we were discussing earlier on, it is the fact that Hopper looks at the Ten Commandments as a holistic model of social perfection that allows him to, you know, actually look at violence and how it's caused. You know, he sees violence as a product of these rules not being upheld. And that, you know, there is a direct causal relationship there. Just drawing an empirical relationship in regards to quantity is, you know, it's like a sort of post hoc thing that he sees no value in. Which is, you know, exactly why Pinker goes wrong here, because he's just trying to sort of assert that, oh, well, there is the state and there is violence and there is no link between the two, especially when the state is the people, you know, the people that set the rules or set maybe even what the standard of violence is. He's not willing to suggest that that might influence the total measure of violence, or that that should, you know, poo-poo the statistics that he's bringing out. Thus, according to Pinker, World War II, with all its atrocities, for instance, had essentially nothing to do with institutions of states, but was a historical fluke, owing to the evil doings of a single deranged individual, Adolf Hitler. Indeed, unbelievably, and seemingly without blushing, although that is admittedly difficult to tell from a written text, Pinker approvingly quotes historian John Keegan, saying that the only one European really wanted war, Adolf Hitler. I mean, this is a point that should sort of be screaming out for anyone that's paid attention to the democratization series, and understanding how much work was put in to make sure that Germany was a prepared war machine Or I will let you see Uncle H's name. Is that an instant demonetization because I've mentioned it too late now, I suppose. But you know, this idea that, oh well, just Hitler took power and then he guided Germany to war, and that there wasn't a long set of continuing circumstances that brewed possibly a sense of revenge in the German people that could then be vindicated through the ballot box by not just Hitler, but a conscious group of elite political actors that were able to accrue that sentiment and carry it forward into something. That seeing the world through that lens to Pinker would have been entirely alien. And it's the only reason why he can then go on to suggest, you know, well, it's only Stalin is the only reason why they killed so many people in communist Russia. Question. But how much evil can a single deranged individual do without the institution of a centralized state? How much evil could Hitler have done with the framework of a stateless society such as those of the Middle Ages? Would he become a great lord, a king, a bishop, or a pope? Indeed, how much evil could have been done with the framework of a thousand many states, such as Liechtenstein, Monaco, or Singapore? Answer, not much. Certainly nothing comparable to the evils associated with World War II. No Hitler, are you back?
Yeah.
Sorry, I wasn't sure if your connection dropped off or not, so I just thought I would start finishing it off.
Yeah, I don't know what happened, but just go ahead. Where are you?
No Hitler, no Churchill, no Roosevelt, or no Stalin. Then no war, as Pinker would have it. Holds not then, but rather no highly centralized state, then no Hitler, Churchill, Roosevelt, or Stalin. Remove the state and they become a Jack the Ripper, a Charles Ponzi, or even harmless person, but not the mass murdering monsters that we know them to have been. Institute the state and you create, attract, and breed monsters. And some, then, Pinker's attempt to rescue the Whig theory of history and demonstrate that we live in the best of all worlds turns out to be an utter failure. Indeed, one may say that this book and its great commercial success is itself empirical proof of the contrary.
Yeah, I was. Did you comment on the question? But how much evil can a single deranged individual do without the institution? And relate it to like a king, a great lord in the Middle Ages?
No, I was going to get back around to that. The very society itself did not produce the opportunities to accrue such a level of power. You know, there would, even in the absolute monarchies of, you know, just prior to the French Revolution. And even because what I find even funnier is that people go further back and you look at serfdom as somehow worse, despite the fact that the hierarchy within serfdom was much more sort of differentiated. You know, it was actually someone who lived up the street was the person that dictated the rules for you, not just the king that lived in the capital. But even in that sense, he was so much more close to the people and accountable to the people in a way that, especially in a democratic state, when you now have the ability to say, well, I have the mandate of the people, so you can't challenge me, otherwise you're going against the people, irrespective of whether or not that's actually true. You know, they're essentially untouchable as they engage in quote-unquote democratic actions.
Yeah, and like I said earlier, is they can't print money. I mean, they could, but people are going to figure it out. I mean, they could try to fake gold, paint lead or something like that, but they're going to have to borrow, or they're going to have to overtax. And you know, it's like you said, if the person living down the street is the person who's coming to collect those taxes from you, well, I mean, they have to sleep sometime.
Yes.
You know, I mean, so yeah, I mean, making the argument that monarchy would, that it was a less violent world under monarchy, sure. I mean, that's just so easy. And you're just not going to, you're not going to get somebody who is either, you know, bought into the regime and the total state like Pinker has, or who at least realizes that he benefits from it so much that you're not going to have somebody who's like him who's going to argue against it, or even better, they're going to write books where they're going to handpick their evidence to argue for it and argue against something like the Whig theory of history, which is so obviously false. And I mean, I know popular anarchists who they may not argue for the Whig theory of history, but a lot of their arguments sound like him.
Mm.
And yeah, so that's troubling, but you know, it's also something that we're all taught. I mean, if we live in the West, we've probably been taught this in their schools.
Well, see, there's almost a point in his own thinking that he's missed, which is if the general temperament of man has been one that moves towards, you know, politeness, civility, sociability, then how can we know that it's the state that's done that? You know, if man is constantly becoming ever more civilized as we move along in time with the state, then how does he know that he's got the relative level of civilization, or sort of, you know, the relative level of civility in man adjusted correctly for the level of violence?
He can't answer that question. I think he would just argue progress.
Mm. But yeah, yeah, he has to replace the complex methodological form that Hopper's engaging with just, well, things were bad before and they'll be better in the future, ergo just now must by definition, in a purely technical sense, be the best of all times.
Well, and it's a very easy argument to make because it's an argument that most people assume already, which is why a book like this can sell so well. Even to people, you know, and this is very much written to like IDW types who will buy into this, are easily going to buy into this because are they going to argue things are getting worse?
Well, see, I mean, it's not just that. The point I was trying to make earlier on with, you know, liberalism is essentially toothless as a political formula if it's not connected to some positive aspect, be that, you know, that liberalism is a positively Christian tradition, it's a positively Western tradition, or it's a positive tradition of this sort of rebel or Robin Hood character, even in that sense. If you aren't willing to connect it to that, and note that I think that would be the thing that would distinguish the IDW from ourselves on a different part of the right, is that like we genuinely believe in something bigger than ourselves that isn't just progress, and I think that actually terrifies them.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden the radicals have entered the room, and people realize now that they're just saying the same thing that leftist liberals and social progressivists and social democrats have been saying for decades and decades. They're just putting a new coat of paint on it.
And I think it's also one of the reasons why a lot of libertarians can read a book like this and get so much out of it, because they have a lot of them instinctively are not only atheist, but like radical atheist.
Yeah. No gods, no kings.
Yeah, yeah. And that is, I mean, it's just...
Well, see, this is why...
I guess it comes from Rand. I mean, but it's really a childish way to look at it. And, you know, it's one of the things, you know, after I stopped going to church, you know, I had my rebellious phase, and I'm sure that my Facebook account is old enough that you can find some, if you went all the way back, you know, 13, 14 years, you could find a couple posts that would be separation of church and state kind of posts. But get older, start reading more people, and you start to realize that, well, you know, that was a mistake. Maybe I need to rethink it.
You become a lot more circumspect.
Yeah.
I think is the appropriate term. Right, I don't... I, I suppose we could probably sit here and babble for hours about stuff, to be quite frank, and I would happily do that. However, you probably get things to do today. So,
Yeah, like eat maybe.
fair enough. And we can just babble once we close the stream down then and make it look like we're productive people.
Okay, good.
I believe I've put most of your links in the description if there's anything else you want to shill.
Oh, just the Pete Quinones show, check it out. And gotta get
You've had
rave
some.
reviews on some of the guests lately.
I was going to say you've had some big folk on, Pedro Gonzalez from Chronicles, and then you had I think you had Anthony Sabatini. Did that one go out today?
Yeah, Anthony Sabatini was released last night. That's fun listening to somebody who was an elected official who's running for Congress, we just need to totally go to war with the left, seize the endowments of universities
What
and
must be
whatever.
done?
Yeah, what must be done? And
See, you'll need to connect me with some of these right-wing Leninist folk. I could have some
and then, and then
interesting
what
conversations.
and then I and then I pulled a sneaky on everyone. I did put up an episode about Russia, Ukraine, and I'm sure everybody who knows me and knows known me for a while was like, "Oh man, Pete's gonna have Scott Horton on." It's like, no, I had Curtis Yarman on to talk about Russia, Ukraine.
As you do. Right. Well, thank you for everyone who tuned in and listened along, and thank you very much for Pete for joining me and reading through. Great to have you on.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Anytime.
Goodbye.